Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, our speaker will be Barbara Sittler, and the title of her talk is Holy Feast. So let's listen in on Barbara.
I did want to teach, but I also wanted to be involved in some sort of more practical application of what I understood theology to be all about, which is sort of interpretation of scripture and tradition and experience, and then doing something with interpretation. So I heard of a joint degree program there, which was a Master of Arts in Master of Divinity, which is the route that you take for ordination, which was merged with the Master of Arts in Social Service Administration at the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. If you took them both, you could get out in 4 years rather than five. And since my master's degree would apply, I did that. So then I got involved in that, and I knew that I wanted to be involved in medical ethics, just sort of ethics in general, how we explain suffering. And geriatrics. And part of that was very much because of what I'd seen both my parents go through.
Yeah.
So, in the meantime, Peter Nash, who is program director here?
Hello.
It's a very, very small group here.
Cozy group here.
Peter Nash, who is one of the program directors this summer, is a friend of mine. So then he said, you know, I'm going to be getting the programs together at Holden for summer of 94. You should be finished with school by then, right? So you could do something on food. And I said, oh, sure, I'll be done with school by then. This was 3 years ago. Well, not quite.
Yeah.
So anyway, the summer came around and they got me for two weeks, one on theology and food, which I had never really given much thought to merging. And theology and medical ethics, which I've given a lot of thought towards. So this is week number two, which I had presumed would be an easier week to do it. But anyway, so that's where I'm at. So I'm intending to get those two degrees, and the question of whether I'm going to be ordained is still a very open question, because I'm not sure that it... because I want to focus on medical ethics, I'm not sure that being ordained is going to add to my credibility or perhaps diminish my credibility if I want to work with people who are not Christian.
No.
So, but we'll see. So that's the thing. But I'm still working as a chef part-time.
Good journey, anyway. Interesting one, it sounds
like. Yeah, it's great. It pays my bills, too. It's just very good. So anyway, so this is this, I've been showing him this book that's at the bookstore, these little table graces. And then this is a book that Susan Briel recommended that I look at, which is really wonderful. It's by this guy, it's a professor of philosophy at the State University in São Paulo, Brazil. He's also a psychoanalyst. He reads very much like sort of poetry and prose. He has a whole section on words which are good to be eaten, which is wonderful. It's wonderful. A lot of the ideas.
Now, is this in the library? Or
I don't think so. This is was her personal contribution. Maybe. I haven't really looked, but it's a wonderful book. And it's got an interesting, it's so weird to see a U-Haul drive by here.
Yeah.
It's an interesting way of thinking about food and poetry and words and ritual, and I've done a lot out of it. Then there's this book, The Rituals of Dinner, The Origins, Evolution, Eccentricities, and Meaning of Table Manners by Margaret Visser or Visor, I don't know which. And I've gotten some material that I was going to talk about today out of this. It's really a fun book. There are lots of different things, but you can talk about the ritual, the symbolism that's in the Eucharist, as well as how we first came about to be using knives and forks. So, it's a beautiful book. And this one, by Diane Ackerman, is A Natural History of the Senses, which is just a very fun book. It's got small little essays on the senses. Very, very fun to read. Tons of essays on smell, touch, taste, hearing, sight. The heart of craving, the psychopharmacology of chocolate. Music and emotion, is music a language? The omnivore's picnic, the shape of smell, buckets of light. It's up there. Mm-hmm. Very fun book to look at. Very small glasses.
Do you saw something that is true?
Oh. Right, because it was I mean, and the reason that we now have knives that are rounded at the tips is because they used to be used as you would spear your meat with them, but you'd also, if there was a disagreement that broke out during the meal, it was used as a weapon. So somebody in the courts changed that around. And the fork was first brought into civilization by Catherine de' Medici, who married a French noble first and brought it to France. And then this one this is one that just came out this year, The Hungry Soul, The Eating and Perfecting of Our Nature by Leon Cass, who's on the faculty at the University of Chicago. This is a very strange book. And
it
starts.
They put that one
on. I think they do.
Yeah,
as a matter
of fact.
I
noticed that one.
Yeah,
and I sort of think I've noticed this.
Well, you know, I'll have to look because I would really like
to
get that. Uh-huh. That's a, yeah, Susan.
I would look, but something triggers in my brain that I saw it and I was wondering, what is that about? I haven't read it.
I really enjoyed that. It's just wonderful to read.
Yeah.
It's almost magical.
To
and this one is very interesting. This is a very strange fellow who wrote this. Do you know Leon Cass? UFC. But he starts with saying, look, we're all animals and we eat to survive. And he starts to talk about just the very fundamental essence of the thing, of our humanity is that we must eat and we were savages and we ate, and it's only after we got to a certain point of development that we actually learned how to eat together without trying to kill each other. Like that. It's a great book to look at.
It fits into some of the things I was talking about today.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Very, very interesting. I'm not sure with all that he says. I'm not even sure that I understand all that he says, but it's really a very different take. So I'll just give you some thoughts that I have. This is by no means, I have not exhausted this topic. And because of my background as a chef, I always think about feasts first from that point of view rather than from my relatively newer incarnation in theology.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm trying to blend in the two things and talk about food that specifically is understood as holy. And then I found that those kinds of distinctions faded away a little bit. Because then I wasn't sure what I would call holy and not holy. Were you at the class we watched Babette's Feast?
Yes.
See, now I would call that definitely a holy feast.
Yeah.
But not by, by classic or traditional standards.
Right.
So I thought that maybe the first thing I would do is talk about how I understand feast, what that means, what it might mean to you, and if you've got anything else to add to it, that'd be great to hear. This is definitely just a jumping off point. But I think in this book, poet, warrior, prophet. Maybe it was that book. I don't even remember anymore. In one of these books, they're talking about feasts being times of ritual relaxation, meaning that there are times when there are set things you go through. A feast has certain components that constantly happen over and over and over again, but essentially there are times in general in which you are relaxing, you're enjoying each other, you're around. And that may not be quite so true for the chef who's putting it on, but that it has both elements of being ritual and entertainment and relaxing. Time's outside of time. It's not work, It's just, it happens in those other times. And you know, part of the ritual is that you think about what you're going to do and you choose who you're going to dine with, you know, choose when, what you're going to eat. It's a time when you can renew the relationships with people you haven't seen in a while or that you see regularly or that you make new relationships. And I was surprised to find out that the word for holy came from the word to heal, which even earlier than that came from the word wholeness. So I like the idea of talking about holy feasts even more. We think about feasts as a time when you gather together, and then a holy feast is one in which you hopefully can promote healing and wholeness of a community or a group or something. Also for any feast, a successful feast is one in which all of the senses are engaged. So everything that makes us human and alive and aware of ourselves inside a body is engaged in a good feast. You're looking at something beautiful, you're smelling it, you're tasting it, you're hearing it, you're touching it. It's a wonderful experience for all of those senses which make us aware of the fact that we're in a body. And then I try to think of what the components were of a feast, any feast, and you usually will talk about food, preferably good food. Mm-hmm. There's always hospitality. You're opening your home to those who you've invited in, or space. The whole notion of invitation is one of hospitality and graciousness. It's a time in which you're not challenging each other.
Yeah.
But although several good feasts that I can think of have been ones with very, very animated table conversation. But right, those rounded off knives. And it's a time of welcome and welcoming in and an invitation. And something that seems most significant to me is that it's a time in which you are caring for the guest. You're inviting in the guest who can be a stranger. And that feasts, or at least meals together, used to always be pulled together or had always as an important factor that there will be people who are traveling who will need shelter and who will need food. And that's been a very big part of how we as a culture have changed from just being people who grab something to eat on our own to developing formal meals, formal meal times with rules and etiquette and standards of behavior and expectations that we move. We have sort of this second order. We have this reflection on what it means to be alive and to be in flesh, is that we need to eat, and therefore those around us also need to eat, and that we have an obligation and sort of a social and cultural obligation to provide that for those who don't have. In the religious sense, or in a religious characterization of this, you could also say that in meeting the stranger and in providing food and shelter for the stranger, you are providing that which God has done for us, or that we may see in the stranger the essence of God, or the appearance of God, or Jesus. And so as we do to the stranger, so we do to God. Now, I wanted to move back a little bit historically. I get a lot of this from me. Oh, I didn't bring the best book. Holy Feast, Holy Fast. Mm-hmm. By Carolyn, I can never remember. Bynum Walker or Walker Bynum. Anyway, it's wonderful. Okay. Holy Feast, Holy Fast. And that talks about the role of feasting and fasting in the medieval period, particularly as it pertains to women, but it's larger than that, in the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries. And she talked about how feasting at that period of time, when feasting really became something, an element of our culture, which continues to this day, feasting we had to understand in a slightly different way, because food was in short supply. So the notion of throwing a feast said a lot about the occasion, that that brought on the feast. And it said a lot about the people who participated in the feast. For example, I mean, it became food, just the notion, food, because it was in such short supply, was an extraordinarily important element of life. It was life. And it became symbolic of a number of things. It became symbolic, first of all, of life itself. And depending on how much food you had and the kind of food that you had, it symbolized also the kind of social strata that you were in. If you had merely grain or meal, you know, you were of a lower class. And if you had other things, you could be extravagant with them, you were clearly more wealthy. To throw a feast also meant that you had the leisure, or either that you had the leisure time to prepare a feast and to invite those around you to participate in this feast, or that the occasion for which you threw the feast was of such significance that you would take the time out of what was a pretty much rugged existence to prepare a feast. Frequently these were timed, the religious holidays, the Eucharist, Seder, times in which the occasion dictated that time must be taken out of the normal day-to-day living to prepare a feast and acknowledge the occasion. Also, feasting in those days became times in which all of the senses were truly engaged, because feasts involved not only food, but involved entertainment and music and extravagances of every kind. So feasting was weighted with heavy significance then. And I want to return to that and think about holy feasts, because it's in that time that the feasts really, holy feasts really started to have characteristics that we can imagine now. So these are things about a feast. And then there's what makes a feast holy. And I've played around with this a lot. I think there are a lot of things that make a feast holy. Many of them are not very different from what I've already mentioned about what a feast is. That it's a time for fellowship and of welcoming in a stranger and of celebrating something and of ritualizing an occasion. Susan Briel mentioned something to me last night. She was explaining sacraments and sacramental theology and talking about it as being the sacrament is a time when the finite, when you take the finite and the infinite breaks into the finite. So that when you're having a feast that revolves around a feast that revolves around a sacrament or that revolves around a religious occasion or belief, it is through having a feast that you allow this infinite truth, this infinite reality to come into this time in which we're all feasting. And that feasts, in that sense, are occasions in which boundaries are completely broken. You're feasting, for example, with the Eucharist. You're feasting now, today, or on Sunday over here, as people have done for 2,000 years, and will be doing, at least theoretically, next week, perhaps for another 2,000 years. But that you're transcending the boundaries of time. You're transcending the boundaries of place. People share the Eucharist in many, many different places. And so that boundary is crossed. All people who share the same set of beliefs, i.e. Christian beliefs, are celebrating the Eucharist somewhere at some time, so that it transcends class. It transcends, let's see, space, time, class, language, culture. It's something that breaks open the finite moment and allows both the infinite in terms of what the Eucharistic message is to enter in, but also allows sort of an infinite transcendent moment that occurs over and over and over again, in which we're reclaiming that again as one moment of the feast here or there or elsewhere. And I think it's, I remember when I was young, we didn't speak of the Eucharist so much in terms of the whole of the come to celebrate the great feast. It was more of a, it was a more austere job all the way around. And I like what's being done these days in talking about, particularly the Eucharist, as I've seen it. I mean, it's maybe in other religious traditions, they're speaking the same way. But that to understand that feasting is when you are satisfying some very specific desires. You are hungry. You need to eat. And we can talk about hunger in a number of different ways, whether we're hungry for transcendence, or we're hungry for forgiveness, or we hunger for communion with our neighbors, or whether we are hungry for food. Is a kind of a celebratory and yet sacramental character, the Holy Feast, that recognizes that we are people in flesh and we eat, we hunger and we eat, whether it's literally or metaphorically, and that to feed that hunger is a loving act. And so we can think about the feast as a love act in some ways. And as we eat, we are satisfying that hunger, but we are also understanding, particularly in the Eucharist, that the final boundary has been crossed, that the Last Supper initiated the Eucharist in which Jesus was the host, and then Jesus becomes the meal afterwards. And so it's a gift of love in which we are actually eating God, loving God, receiving God's love, and in a way we're assimilating that which we know of God in a very concrete manner. And we can come to know God there's nothing more sacramental, that's probably the ultimate way in which the infinite comes into the finite, that we are receiving God into our bodies. It's a very erotic image. It's a very heavily weighted image.
I was telling somebody how when I was young and growing up, and we used the wafers so long in church, I know, and when we started using the bread, I had always looked at the meal as, you know, Christ coming in and wanting to change what I was and let him be myself, you know, what I was. It is very hard when you have a big hunk of bread. It doesn't dissolve very fast. I mean, that little wafer dissolved. And it really, when we first started doing it, I really liked it because that awareness was there. It was sticking in the top of my. And I don't chew the bread. I never do. It's just a thing I have that I want myself to dissolve and be gone and me to be what's showing. And I tell you, when you get a big hunk of bread, you have to think about it for a while. So it was a very good, you know, it was a good lesson for me. I like that, you know, having the bread.
That's interesting. I've never
reminder. You know, I see people just chew it up and it's down, but it wasn't the way I looked at taking.
Well, you know, in the Middle Ages, people used to take the bread and take it home because they believed it was truly the body of Christ, and then they would keep it around the house, and that was it was like a talisman almost. And they would eat it. So then it became, that's when it came, so that you would open your mouth and the priest would put it in your mouth so that, to make sure that you would actually eat it and not use it as a sort of a lucky charm, change the whole nature of how it was given.
Yeah, I sort of missed that when they put it in your mouth, because that was, to me, another symbol that there's nothing, absolutely nothing you can do. A reminder that I come to you, you know, whether you do anything or not, I sort of missed that too, but it, you know, things change.
I've always hated it when the communion would pass through the pews.
Yeah.
You know, you hand it over.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought something that was sort of, it's like passing the popcorn at a movie theater.
I've not been in a congregation where they pass the communion in pews, but I've appreciated being part of a smaller worshiping community where we pass the communion to each other. It for me, it forms a sense of, it adds to the dimension of the sense of community that, you know, we really are called together and bound together by Christ, and the sense of the communion did that and for me. And so when I'm in smaller gatherings, I really do like it when we're able to pass it to each other.
This last year, I had an internship at a Filipino Methodist congregation, very small. And we would have, the church itself was in downtown Chicago, but the congregation lived all over metropolitan Chicago, which is a vast area. So we would have all of our services on Sundays. Now, even on Sundays, we would have maybe 50 people there, which is small, but that's a fair amount of people. But we would have midweek services, like Ash Wednesday, we had a midweek service, which only those people who really could come would come. And we had maybe 15. And then the pastor had the ashes and the oil. So you dip your thumb in the oil. And one of she put the cross on me and then handed it to me. And then I turned around and did it to the next person. And we all passed around, and it was incredible. Watching these little children put the cross on their parents, remember that you are destined to best your child return. Mm-hmm. It was amazingly charged, I thought. Mm-hmm. And I've never had communion given so that it passes from one to the other, but it sounds like a great way to do that.
I put it in the winter, or late fall and spring. It's a little small community.
Here?
We in this room for the mountains, for the Sunday evening service.
It's in here? Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that's nice.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that sounds great to me.
Where did I distract you?
Where I was. No, that's fine. I mean, I think one of the luxuries of being on this teaching staff at Holman is that if you're lucky, you get, you know, like I'll get four times as much as you will, or 20 times more. Or, you know, it's wonderful.
You started by talking about the sacramental, and what Susan had shared with you about.
Okay, so in the sacrament, in the sacramental nature of a feast, you take what would normally be the profane and make it sacred. And that's done in a number of ways by the words of institution, if it's in the, we're talking about Eucharist. But it's also, I believe that you make things sacred by referring back and forward to elements that are truly timeless or not rooted in a particular time and space. Or you recall something that happened at one point and it has continuous meaning throughout time and space. So that when you gather together with the Eucharist or the Seder, these are two real good examples, you're recalling what happened, the time that went past, you're remembering and reminiscing. But you're remembering because it has as much meaning now as it did then, and that it can, you know, and it's not stopped in time. It's not just, yeah, I remember that because it was a funny thing or an important story, but because it breaks anew into each moment with fresh meaning and also the same meaning, and it becomes sacred. You're reawakened to both the occasion that the feast celebrates, and you're also reawakened to this sort of hungering desire that created the need for that feast in the first place. That there was a great desire to have God come into our life, to see the whole holy covenant that had been given to us in the Old Testament in a new way, in a way that was much more inclusive, and that we hungered for inclusion and safety and love and redemption, and that the Eucharist is one way in which we remember the hunger, remember the desire, and also reenact the satisfaction of that hunger. And I would maintain that that's entirely what a feast, I mean, that those are the finest elements of what a feast is, and you desire, and you satisfy that desire in some very, very significant, almost ritual ways. There's, I wonder if I this is here.
I was going to say to flesh that out a little, but that's probably not exactly the word that I want to use. This was also something that developed over time. We can read in, I believe it's in Corinthians 11, where Paul is talking to the Corinthians and saying, you know, this Eucharist is trying to remind people that this is in fact a holy feast, and it's not an occasion to gather on Sunday night and gobble up food and wine and get drunk. So that this is something that's developed over time too. I think we have to recognize that it didn't spring up, and we haven't handled this perfectly at all times. And that feasts themselves, while they refer to a kind of holy feast, refer to a kind of a transcendent truth, are also things which need to change over time. And even the fact that now we're eating bread and calling it more of a celebration is, I think, slightly different than what we had done before. And we've changed the notion of it being a frugal meal to opening up to the joy of celebration while we're in fact not having a meal, but we're still remembering it as a meal in the sense that we satisfy our desires. Now, one thing that was very interesting to me in thinking about this, as a chef and as a woman, is the whole nature of food and food preparation, how that has fit into our culture from time, as long back as we can go, is that women have been the ones who have prepared food, who have taken care that food is provided, and who are also seen in some more poetic ways as being food themselves. That's worked to our advantage in many ways, that we're seen as mother and source of life, source of food, breastfeed our children, and that we care for the more mundane aspects of existence, but without which care, no other existence would happen. On the other hand, it can be used as a way of diminishing the contribution, and also of weighting the notion of feasting and celebration with a kind of a fearfulness of the sensuality or the dangers of sensuality that might be hooked onto that. Women are flesh, men are spirit. There's been this sort of classic dichotomy that's cut through much of how we understand Western Christianity, at least. And I think about that a lot when I see myself as a chef preparing to be pastor. And there's a certain suspicion at times about women. You know, just, do you have your head screwed on straight? You know, this isn't a bacchanalian thing here. This requires a greater reflective quality. We will call it a feast, but we won't wallow in it. We won't rejoice in it the same way. And I think there are some problems with that, both for men and for women, for all of our culture. I think that women have a funny relationship with food, as that they are seen as food, they prepare food, they battle with food. In the medieval period, in this book that I failed to put down, women
women's piety was strongly focused around the whole notion of food and feasting. And they wanted to become closer and closer to God and to Christ particularly. And so it was at that period that the first evidences of anorexia developed, that women would see themselves as enfleshed, and they wanted to, that the food would create flesh, and flesh grew into fertility, and that women create, you know, were responsible for the reproduction of the species in a more long-term process than men were responsible for. And that flesh was seen as largely pleasurable, and hence abhorrent, you know, in a sense, to true spiritual union with God. But if you refused food, you didn't have flesh, and rather than becoming fleshy, you were becoming more part of the spirit, and you would start to suffer through lack of food and through just denying your own fleshly existence, and you would more closely approximate the suffering, the life and suffering of Jesus Christ. And so that there was a great deal of piety that was brought into that, which I found is very interesting. There was a lot also in the medieval period of seeing women's bodies as being similar, as women's bodies as food, were very similar in positive ways. I was really angry I didn't bring that book, because there's some beautiful pictures of Jesus standing there with breasts, with milk coming out of it, that was a very giving and loving aspect also. So there was a real tension between these two different ways of seeing women and bodies. And I think that we're going through that same tension now, not necessarily only with women and bodies, but with the whole notion of food, sensuality, genders, who we are, what we're doing with what we're doing, how far we trust sensuality, when does sensuality become sexuality, and then hence problematic and filled with anxiety. And I also see that in the medieval period then, that there was this very rich wealth of symbols, wealth of options for how the symbols would work out. So positive, Christ as mother, woman as food, woman as provider, or also with the symbolism of food as being something you want to pull yourself away from so that you can more closely approximate the suffering of Christ. Whereas now, I think our symbolism is fairly narrow and fairly negative. Food is either real fun stuff, and we go to McDonald's and chow down on something which doesn't do anything for us, or food is seen as something that is heavily weighted with negative characteristics, something we've got to be very careful of. And that too, when we look at food and feasting and fun and revelry, we're moving away from that, which is the finest part of what it is to be human. So, for example, here at Holden, there's a very careful, there's a very strong commitment to providing good, nourishing food. And yet there seems to be almost a political aspect to how we eat, because we have to be very careful that we're doing the right things. We're eating the right food, or perhaps not eating the wrong food. We should eat not so much meat, not so much fat, and there's not a trusting amongst many people here that we will choose the right food to eat. We've got to box it in, we've got to define ourselves. Our we've got to define ourselves through the way that we eat. Mm-hmm. And I would maintain that kind of definition of how we handle food then removes the possibility of feasting.
Have you talked about that with the new leadership?
Yes.
I think that's a very important move for Holden to make, is to talk about that again.
I've never been up here before. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of my conversations in the evening have been about food. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's great to think about food and to think about what you're going to eat, you know, and to put some concern into it. But I think when you stop looking at it as something sort of organic to life, I mean, it is absolutely organic. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely tied into life. But you turn it into a political statement, you remove the possibility of feasting with it, of having it become, of having it be integral with the rest of life. And there's all kinds of problems with that. But
I agree.
So this, when I think about that, then I have to go back to the beginning again and say, okay, well, so then what is a feast? What are holy feasts? And as I said before, I think that movie Babette's Feast was a perfect example of a holy feast. I was wondering today whether our solidarity lunch was a holy feast. I wonder if any of you have any thoughts on that. It certainly is a time of remembrance.
Well, in a way, to me, it depends on what you do with that. If you run right down and buy a hot fudge sundae and a couple of candy bars, then it is not a holy feast because you haven't really endowed it with the, you know. I don't know. I was thinking of that today. You know,
Jim Oinous was talking about.
Really in the money that goes to help the people, which we are glad to do and probably wouldn't do because we just wouldn't think about it. It's a reminder in that way. I mean, I'm glad they do it and bring out what a difference it makes in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And a reminder that when you go home, you know. I have found since we had a sermon on loaves and fishes, and I really, it's just, you know, how many times have I heard that in a lifetime? I'm old, I've heard it lots of times.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, this year, it just has bugged me, and it has changed the way I go out and buy my groceries.
And in what way?
Because it just made me think there are so many things that you don't really need. I have a big meal every Sunday, and I call that a holy feast in a way. I was thinking about that because nephews and nieces and all my kids and that gather, and it's our way after church of celebrating we are a family. Maybe we haven't touched bases all week. Sometimes we touch them every day, but a lot of times you don't. And to me, that is a holy feast. It is a reminder we are a family. You know, we worship together, you come back to Grandma's for dinner. And you might not only be there long enough to eat, and sometimes they say thanks a million, goodbye, and you don't see them anymore for the day. But I consider that sort of a holy feast. And, but I don't know, but even at that meal, I sometimes have much more than we need.
Mm-hmm.
I've changed what I put, you know, I like to put pretty color, I like it to be a pretty meal. That's something I don't wear in that school or something.
Yeah, you learn because you're part of the human race.
Yes.
And that's how we learn it. It's,
you know, but I have,
you're dining with all your senses.
I think I would, I don't know. I just felt there are ways I can cut back and this meal can still be just as special and I can give a little more to church. I felt a great need to give more. I think we have. I don't know why, but that parable just drove me nuts this year. Probably because we are seeing so much on the TV and on the news, you know, and I think you still can eat nice without overdoing all the rich things. It used to be a treat when I was a kid. If you had a cake on Sunday, man, that was a treat. Now there's junk every day, you know, and so it isn't special anymore. And so what I'm trying to do is cut back on. The way it struck me is I need to cut back and make it special once again to have something,
mm-hmm.
you know. Not that I'm going to cut out all the special things, but it's just bothered me this year that we have so much more than we really need. And, I don't know why, I'm sure a lot of it
when
is
he was talking about that one tortilla and the one egg.
Yeah.
That's a pretty meager feast.
But yet I think that it had all of the other components of gathering together and really highlighting those values that make us that make us human and sort of evolved.
When I was in I believe in Guatemala, 4 or 5 years ago, we were visiting a base community, poor area. We got by on food, but the thing that stood out is that there were these 3 or 4 women who had captured this eagle. They were raising this eagle because that was going to be the village feast.
Eagle.
And that, you know, at a certain time in a certain place, they were going to have something more than just the givens that they could get from the land. And so I think that across class, across cultures, there is this desire, this yearning, as Martin Welsh was talking about the other night, to gather together for something special, to treat yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And part of their vocation was to feed this thing. And they did. They had it there and okay. And you all come back. If you're here, you can have the house with us. But, so rather impressive.
You need to celebrate. I think that God wanted us to be, you know, do without all the time. I think He expected us to have celebration.
Yeah, and I think that the celebration and even the feasting has I mean, certainly some of it has to do with the food that is served.
Yeah.
And I would be the last to say that it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it has a lot to do with all of the other stuff. The bringing in, the welcoming of the stranger or of the guest and of being host and of graciousness and hospitality and remembrance and transcendence and ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a feast on rice and beans if those other things are there. And so I guess, I'm thinking out loud, I guess that if we had that sense of all of those other things being present at the solidarity lunch, then it would be a feast.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's that. But I'm fearful that we start to make food the central element of how we decide whether something is right or not, whether it's righteous or holy. And it's not what's being served, it's how it's being served and what goes into creating that meal and that environment. And that's why I worry about sort of a politically correct way of eating, because we're forcing the concentration on the food and not on those elements that come into creating a meal. And if we see a meal just for, if it were for us here, or if we see that there are meals that have to be had all through the world, we make sure that people have enough to eat, because that's the value. It's, that's one of the values, and we spread it around. But we don't focus on, it's a feast if we have Blini's Demidoff. And it wouldn't be, Babette did make a wonderful feast.
Uh-huh.
She could have made another, she could have also made a feast using things that were more pedestrian.
Mm-hmm.
If she had had the same element, the same care for the environment, the same meaning that animated this gathering. So I would call many occasions holy feasts. And I don't know if that's heresy or not. Thoughts on this.
Lately, probably the last year or so when I was able to, for some years I've been interested in holiness and daily life and holiness in the ordinary. So, it seems to me how I've come to think about that in the last year or so has to do with feeling the presence of God in the moment of holiness, in the time. And often my experience has been, in the past year, it's been these people who are trying to make it. I mean, trying to survive, trying to live, or living in a very simple, simple, simple way. But being good, happy there. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, as compared to some of my other life, which is more oriented toward now. See, how can I make more money here, or how can I do this or what? So, the holy feast idea for me, whether or not it's heresy, I have no idea, but how it relates to me and to how I think about that has to do with the holiness in our daily lives and where we meet God in our daily lives and how that happens. I mean, we don't really do a whole lot about that. I mean, God comes to us. But it for me, it has been being in a reflective mode so that, I mean, sometimes I will go through a few days probably, and it'll be when I am looking back and thinking about, now let's see, oh yes, that moment was very special. There was something very special about that moment or that time or that person or in that place. And then I have come to call those holy times. Now, I don't know, you know, I mean, that's just, and I've felt really thankful that they have happened to me more and more.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, 3 or 4 years ago when I used to think about this stuff, it was sort of like, now what is this? And now I'm able to, I can look back and say, that time felt holy. That time was very holy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I relate to the holy.
You see, and it seems to me, I mean, I'm wondering if this is part of what you're saying, is that in the actions that we take, or the choices about the actions that we take, allows that holiness, that holy moment to occur, so that to go back to the feasting thing, in the notion that we will gather and share and remember and take the time out to do just that. You know, that allows, I think, that allows for the holiness to enter, or to emerge. I'm not sure how I'd like to see that, but I, for myself, I definitely see that as a way in which the holy
is experienced.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, you know, I don't want to put directional things on that, but
for me, it has.
It's very ordinary.
For me, it has to do with sort of presenting myself. That's about all I can do, is present myself in a particular kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
And being there and being open to not knowing exactly what's going to happen next or where it's going to go, or and being present to that place, to that person, to that situation. That's where I experience the holiness.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't too much I can do. I just kind of...
But then it sounds to me like very much about the time thing too, that you sort of stop time and let...
Yes. And sometimes I don't realize it's holiness until later.
Right, sort of absolutely.
Other times it will feel very, very powerfully. This is important.
Mm-hmm.
Stop. Pay attention to this.
And the other times are really important. You've sort of gotten away from that. It's your time to listen and
be heard.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes life is just too too hectic. I mean, I think we need those quiet times, and I think they give you a sense of order in your day, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that, but a lot of times that's missing now because we're too busy doing things.
Yeah, it's also one of the few times that, in mm-hmm. a sense, is non-directed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're going to have the foods on the table, but then you let us... What?
The other thing just came to me, I was... I have different people that I have kind of an ongoing relationship with that I don't really socialize a lot with, but they're really important to me. The people are very important to me. And we have this sort of significant relationship. And so I found myself, again, this is how all happened last year, so I eat here with Martin, and I eat here with Susie, and I eat here with...
Yeah,
and I go to the same place with that person. And then I go to a different place with that person. And
when you're getting this ritual and remembrance, and it's you're stopping time because they all have a piece.
And about once a month, I'll call up this one person, I'll say, how are you doing? You know, I've been thinking about you or something. And then we say, well, it's time to have lunch.
And we set up you know where to be. And yeah, that's true. That's funny.
And
I haven't thought about
that.
That
becomes a holy time in that relationship with that person.